Well, he's put a lot of pressure on me last time and this time. Last time he said, I'm going to come up here, I'm going to battle the flesh. And now he said, I'm going to come and speak with clarity. And so I have to live out what the titles are. But that's where we are in your notebook. It's page 23, I believe. We're on the subject of preaching with clarity. This is a very kind of narrow focus. It's on the communication side of preaching, what can help that and what can hinder it. If we had more time, we would actually go into other topics that are necessary topics for preaching. In other words, I like to teach on the subject of effective preaching, and I really believe there are four keys to effective preaching, and this is just one of the four. Just so you'll know, the four keys to effective preaching are, from my perspective, is number one, accuracy, and then number two, clarity, and number three, passion, and number four, Christ focus. So accuracy, clarity, passion, and a Christ focus. You can turn those around and word them differently as a command. You can say it's important to be accurate, and number two, be clear, and number three, be passionate, and number four, be Christocentric, be how I would like to say it, you know, Christ-focused. So I'm actually just drilling down on one of those keys to effective preaching, and that is that second one, clarity. You have a quote there from Haddon Robinson, the effectiveness of our preaching depends on two factors, what we say and how we say it. And so this is really more dealing with the second half of that, the how, but certainly the what is important. The what is related to the accuracy key. Exposition, then, the exposition of God's Word is an art of crafting our exegesis. Exegesis, as you know, is digging into the text to find out what God says and what God meant to say through that author, what the author believed he was saying, what the audience heard, the original audience. We exegete that passage, and we get out of it the information of what is being said in that passage. But then we have to do something with all that. We craft it into a sermon, and that becomes exposition. Nolan Howington, the exegete is like a diver bringing up pearls from the ocean bed. An expositor is like the jeweler who arrays them in an orderly fashion and in proper relation to each other. So we're jewelers. We're giving the final product to the congregation. And we want to be effective in it. The major point is, of this seminar, there is good communication and there is bad communication. Which one does the Lord deserve? His truth is so valuable. It's more valuable than gold and pearls. It demands clarity. Clarity of understanding and clarity in presentation. Now, before we go on, let me just remind you of a good definition of expository preaching. Expository preaching is explaining what the text says, explaining what the text means by what it says, and then explaining how it applies to life. That's Bible exposition. What the text says, but what it means by what it says, and then how it applies to life. Those three elements are the elements overall of expository preaching. And so when we preach an expositional message, that's what we're doing with that passage. We are explaining what it says, what it means by what it says, and how it connects with us in life. Now, what are we preaching? There's a preaching unit. Generally, it is a paragraph of Scripture. That's the most common preaching unit, is a paragraph of Scripture. And different Bibles and translations sort of mark those for you, but you can read and kind of determine, here's a paragraph of thought, the preaching pericope, the unit of preaching. But it doesn't necessarily have to be a paragraph of 2, 3, 4, 5, 8 verses. You can be an expository preacher and preach expositionally in just handling a verse expositionally, explaining what that verse says and what it means by what it says and how it applies to life. That's expository preaching. It could be a whole chapter. It could be a book. You could do an exposition of a book in a sermon. I actually heard a pastor, Mark Dever, do an exposition of the New Testament, Old Testament in one sermon, and then the New Testament in another sermon. And boy, you're just hitting the peaks, that's for sure. But he's still doing that. This is what it says, this is what it means, and this is how it applies. But most of my conversation when I talk about preaching is meant to conjure up the idea of having a paragraph of Scripture, preaching through a book, for example, in your church, and you're taking paragraph by paragraph and you're going through that book and expositing the passages for the congregation. So we want to be clear in that. Now, if you'll turn to the back of your notes, you have a diagram that I kind of want to start with, and I may, it's on page 29, I may refer to it a few times here and there, at least I'll probably come back to it at the end, but I want you to go ahead and label these boxes, and I'm not going to talk about these boxes in order that you see them from top to bottom, but we will address all of them. But this is a picture of an expository sermon, right? That's what you preach, right? Right there. There it is. Any questions? We'll do Q&A now. So that explains everything. Okay. Okay. The top box. Intro or introduction. Okay. You figured that one out. Introduction. That has an arrow on it. And the arrow is to impress the idea that an introduction is pointing towards something and it's getting people on a path. In fact, if I were you, I would draw a line up there at the top and just kind of draw a dotted line or something like that all the way through, down right through the middle of all the boxes, down below to the bottom down here with an arrow tip on the end to give the impression that this is a journey you're taking people on in this sermon. You're starting them on this path and you want to keep them on this path and you're taking them right down this path for a purpose all the way to the end so that there's a flow of thought that I'll talk about in a moment. Second box. Underneath that arrow tip is, you can call it theme statement. Theme statement. It has other words, but we'll use that one. You can just put theme if you want. Theme or theme statement. That smaller box underneath it, label it plural noun proposition. Plural noun proposition. That's three words. Plural, as opposed to singular. Noun, as opposed to verb and adverb and so forth. In case you don't understand my accent. I guess I have an accent when I come here, right? Isn't that funny? I mean, you think you don't. You're the ones without the accent. All of you have accents. I'm trying to understand you. I just speak plain English, you know. Everybody thinks that about their language. And anyway. So I guess I have an American accent blended in with some southern tinges, southern American accent. Plural noun proposition is that little box. The next three boxes that are all the same size, you can just put a number in it, 1, 2, and 3 if you want. Those represent points of a sermon. Not that every sermon has 3 points. Some sermons have 2, some have 4, and so forth. We've had some sermons this week that have had 7 and 8. But it's good for teaching purposes. Good old-fashioned three-point sermon. Okay, so point 1, point 2, point 3. And the last box is what? Conclusion. Conclusion. So those are your major elements of an expositional sermon. There's really 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 elements. You've got your introduction, your theme statement, your plural noun proposition, your outline, which is the body of the sermon, and then the conclusion. So with all that labeled, and I'll keep referring to them, I want to go back to page 1 of the notes, and we're going to talk about that theme statement first of all. So we're going to jump in right there, not start talk about the introduction yet. The theme statement. You'll notice in your notes that to help your clarity, first of all, you want to identify the proposition, that's another word for it, or the theme, the main theme of the passage. I cannot overemphasize how crucial this is. Sermons break down for this reason as much as any other reason, if not more, is the pastor, the preacher really hasn't identified what is the one single point of this passage. Not the points that you're going to flesh out in an outline, but I'm talking about the big picture. What is this passage about? What's the one point that it's making? If you can't identify the one point that a passage is making, if you cannot put that in a one, at the most two sentence answer, if I asked you, what is this passage about? Then you're not ready to form outline points and introductions and conclusions. I teach expository preaching at a seminary in the States, and I have found this to be true in my own ministry and certainly in the students that I listen to because I teach it, and then they start preaching sermons, and we critique them, you know, a class of five or six guys in the class and myself, we listen to the sermon, we have a form we go by, they preach it for 30 minutes, and then we has to be a minimum of 28, maximum of 31, or I count off points, and there's a form we follow of all the ingredients that we're listening for, and so we give constructive criticism when they get done. And every once in a while, you have a student, and more often than I'd like to admit, that what they just gave was, for lack of a better word, a mess. I mean, it was just a mess of stuff. And you can tell they're up there sweating. I mean, they're struggling, trying to fix it on the fly, you know, live. And I have found more than not what their was causing their struggle is they really hadn't even identified what's the one theme statement of this passage. And so I'll just ask them that. You know, they have to stand up there and answer questions and be criticized and constructively and all that and be given help. Now ask him, okay, just don't look at your notes, just look at me. What's that passage about? What's Paul saying? And they'll kind of think about it for a second, you know, and sometimes, you know, they're really struggling with trying to find it, which tells them why they had such trouble with the sermon. Although sometimes, if they'll just not look at their notes, if they'll just engage their mind for a moment, they'll say, well, basically, Paul he's describing what a godly man looks like. I'm going, okay, that's the point. And that did not come out in your sermon at all. But once you were forced to think about it, you got it. It's crucial. So if you're struggling with clarity at any level or struggling making the outline work, I just can't figure out how to outline it, I promise you this may be the problem. Stop what you're doing, get back, read the paragraph again, and ask yourself that simple question, what's he saying? Try to be able to word it to your spouse in one sentence. You must be able to summarize the one point of the passage. Now, and I'll give you a couple of examples here, but you do want to state it as a timeless principle. You want to put it in timeless form. For example, let's just take an example. Three or four. Psalm 3, one of my favorite psalms. I love to preach Psalm 3. This is a psalm. If I was just going to tell you, since it's David's in a difficult spot, he's being chased by Absalom, he's out there in the desert with his few remaining men that remaining loyal to him, and he's lost the kingdom and all that, he's in a very difficult place, and yet he has such great assurance and confidence. So the main theme of that psalm, I would say, is something like this, it's assurance or confidence in the face of adversity. Timeless means I don't want to say it about David. The theme of this psalm is David was able to have assurance in the face of adversity. Why do I not want to couch it in those terms to my congregation? If that's all I do. And then preach a message about how David was able to have confidence. David did this, point number one. Number two, David did this, point number three. Two, and number three, then David did this. Because people then sit there thinking, boy, that was great for David. I'm glad it all worked out for him. What does that have to do with me? It's timeless, the principles. So I would state it like this in one sentence. I might say like something like this, Psalm 3. God's people can have assurance in the face of any difficulty. That brings it up past David. I mean, I'm going to mention David, obviously. But it brings it up to all of us, for God's people. Let's take, you can turn to these passages if you want, 1 Corinthians 6, 12 to 20. And the reason I want you to look at this one is sometimes the theme is given to you in the passage. It's got neon lights flashing on it, not at the first verse, maybe, in this case, 1 Corinthians 6. In this case, if you look at verses 12 through 20, you actually find one command in the entire passage. And if there's one command in this entire passage, I can tell you for sure, you better notice that. That is controlling this entire passage. That's the theme. It's all the way down in verse 18. First two words. Flee immorality. I guarantee you, this whole paragraph that starts at verse 12, it goes all the way through verse 20. That's a preaching unit. Try to preach it in one sermon if you can. If not, you have one outline over it. It might be a part one and a part two, but still one outline over this passage. It's about fleeing immorality. I guarantee you. Everything around it, before it and after it, is supporting that. So this one was easy because it's in neon lights flashing to you. Now, I might word it a little differently. Something like this. We must avoid sexual sin of any kind. There's the theme. We must avoid sexual sin of any kind. Timeless is we. I don't want to say Paul is telling the Corinthians that they must avoid sexual sin. So let's see what Paul tells the Corinthians of how they can avoid sexual sin. It's true. But people go, but what does that have to do with me? I thought the Bible applied to me. This is great for the Corinthians. It doesn't take but just a little wording to make it timeless, right? We must avoid sexual sin of any kind. I'll get to it in a moment, but my outline of the sermon is going to flesh out and develop that theme right there. If your outline is not fulfilling that theme right there, something's wrong. There's a disconnect. Let me give you another one. I think it's in your notes. Hebrews, well, if you look down later on, you'll see Hebrews 12, 1 to 3 there. I'm still up in letter A, but let me just use that one for a moment. Hebrews 12, 1 to 3. This is the passage right after Hebrews 11. That's profound, is it not? What is Hebrews 11? It's that great chapter dealing with faith, the hall of faith. And based upon all that, this is that running the race sort of verses, 1, 2, and 3. And if you study that, the theme of it is something like this. The Christian is in a race. And we must be faithful to endure in this race till the end. There's the theme. We're in a race. The walk with Christ is a race. And we must faithfully endure all the way to the end. And that passage tells us how to do it. I don't want to say this passage today is about these Jewish Christians that were reading this letter, who were undergoing a lot of trouble and persecution, how they could endure in their persecution. It's true, but I want to make it applicable and timeless to the congregation. Maybe one more. John 13, 31 to 35. That's that upper room scene, John 13, 31 to 35. You know that scene. Judas has just left. There's a change in atmosphere. He's gone off to sell Jesus. And now Jesus talks to the 11. He has them. Those few little verses basically make this point. Jesus makes this point. To properly represent Christ in the world, his followers must be marked by love for one another. Okay. To properly represent Christ in this world, because he's going away, he tells his followers, this is how they'll know. His followers of Christ are marked by love for one another. That single point theme goes in that one box there, the second box down that you've already marked. So that little box controls everything. So again, Psalm 3, not just about David. John 13, what I just talked about. It's not, this is what the disciples of Jesus, the original 11 disciples of Jesus, must now do before they die. No, it's for you and me too. So this takes some work. If you're struggling, go back and try to make another attempt at identifying the theme. Letter B. Next, determine a propositional statement that contains this key word that is a plural noun. A plural noun. This statement is the objective now of the sermon. It's the objective of the sermon. I've given the theme of the passage, but now this is the objective of the sermon. This is how I'm going to flesh out that theme of what this is about. So it's a simple sentence just stating the theme that's going to be amplified now and explained, improved, and all that. And it contains that key word, a plural noun. I've given you some examples. 1 Samuel 15, 13 to 31. I entitled that sermon, Diagnosing Heart Disease. This narrative portion of Scripture gives us, by way of illustration, four symptoms of an unrepentant heart, as you look at that interaction between the prophet and Saul when he didn't wipe out the Amalekites like he was supposed to, you know. The plural noun is symptoms. Four symptoms of an unrepentant heart. Guess how many outline points there are? Four. Guess what each one of those outline points are? A symptom. Hebrews 12, 1-3, running for the cause, I think is what I entitled it. I've already said the theme, we need to endure. In this passage, Paul presents three keys for running the Christian race with endurance. I'd said the theme was that the Christian life is a race and God expects us to persevere to the end. But how do we do that? How are we possibly going to live that way? Well, in this passage, Paul presents three keys to help us for running the Christian race with endurance. There's not a disconnect between this plural noun statement and the theme. The plural noun statement is fleshing out the theme. Sometimes a sermon breaks down because they're disconnected. They're not really one doing the helping the other, and people are trying to figure out what's going on. Romans 1, 1-7. Four observations. There's the plural noun. If you have your notes with you, I want you to thumb through the pages for a moment. I want you to look at some of Smedley's notes and Joel's notes. Let's critique them here for a moment. They're not here. Look at page 45. Do you have that syllabus? If you don't, I'll narrate it for you. But page 45. Waiting for Jesus, Philippians 3, 20-21. Look at that big, bold sentence there. Three reminders that radically affect everyday life. Each outline point is one of those reminders. Look at some of Joel's notes. Look at page, can't read my writing, page 63, I think it is. And by the way, this was a topical seminar. I went to his seminar on depression. He's got more than one example of this in a topical seminar. This format that we're using here, that I'm giving you, works for topical sermons too, if you want to be clear. What's amazing is how many good speakers out there in the secular world follow this same pattern. Some president, you know, who's retired, gets invited to go speak at a graduation. And so he speaks and he says, I'd like to give you four lessons that I learned about life while I was the president. You know, four lessons. It just makes sense. They're for something. There's one word you're not allowed to use. If I hear that you use this word, I'm coming back over here to your church and meet with you. Things. Now, good people I love and respect say that word sometime, but don't use things. Things is the plural noun that works on every passage in the Bible. Three things, two things, four things, six things, 12 things. What kind of things? Be a little more creative than that. Look on page 63. Look at the top of the page. Nine helpful questions to ask depressed counselees. You look in the next couple of pages and there's all these questions. You keep going, I think all the way to 67, 60, actually before that, he gets into the answer of how to help them. Page 60, bottom of page 64, 12 solutions. I mean, you got to call it something. It's a structure. He has a sermon on, look at page 75. Page 75. Look at the top there. Three reasons that the church is not to incorporate worldly wisdom into the gospel to update it or improve it. Each one of those is a reason. It's not two reasons and then a result. It's three reasons. That's what he told the people he was going to give, and he did. Page 79, you follow this all the way through. Five stages of the church building process. Page 81, three concerns at the top. At the bottom, Psalm 51, five marks of biblical repentance. Lots of words you can use. Hebrews 12, we've already seen that. If you go back just one page in your syllabus, I commented on it, but that Hebrews 12. example. It was 3-something in your notes. 3 keys, yeah. Romans 1, verses 1 to 7, 4 observations, and so forth. Now, that's all very, very important now. That's that other little block. You've got your theme statement. You've got your plural noun proposition that's giving guidance down now to your outline. And so at some point in your study process, you obviously, letter C, need to form an outline. Now this outline, your preaching outline, is going to fulfill that plural noun proposition that fleshes out the theme statement. It's all connected. This outline should reflect syntactical analysis of the passage. That's just a fancy way to say that the text itself determines how many points there are. The text does. Now, this is not a seminar on how to do exegesis. They have seminars like that sometimes in the Shepherd's Conference. There's good books on that. Joel has some material on that that's very helpful. I would get it if I were you on all of this, actually. But it's the exegetical process. It's evaluating the passage that helps us understand whether there's 2 points or 3 points or 4 points, because we find where the breaks are. So let's talk about that. How do you know where the breaks are? What are you looking for? Well, sometimes you're looking for some grammatical keys of some sort. And a classic passage we use to teach this is Ezra 7:10. I mean, this verse is in the Bible for more than one reason, but one reason is it's the ideal verse to use to teach expository preaching. So you have it in your notes, Ezra 7:10. For Ezra had set his heart to study the law of the Lord and to practice it and to teach his statutes and ordinances in Israel. What's interesting is the word and, the conjunction and, occurs 3 times. You might be tempted that that's separating it into 4 parts. Ezra had set his heart to study the law of the Lord, and, number 2, to practice it, and, to teach his statutes, and, 4, ordinances in Israel. But it's not. That last and is a minor and, not a major and. The major and is that first one and the second one. That last and is subdividing the third point into 2 subpoints. They're parallel statements. Plus, you notice another grammatical key here. There's what we call an infinitive. In English, it's that little word to with a verb. Ezra had set his heart. There's the overall sort of tone of the passage right there. You're going to explain all that, what it means. But then he set his heart to accomplish 3 purposes, for example, or 3 results of his commitment, you know, something like that. To study, to practice, and to teach. That confirms that there's 3, those 3 infinitives. And the last point, to teach, you have 2 subpoints, statutes, number 1, number 2, ordinances. And what's the difference? So this is a real easy kind of verse to see how you would divide the verse based on some grammatical keys. Sometimes, though, it's not grammar. By grammar, you're looking at conjunctions, prepositions, things like that. Sometimes it's content. The content itself is dictating where the breaks are. There's a change in subject matter, minor changes in a subject matter within the paragraph. Content changes. There's an introduction of something new, or there's repetition going on. There's a change in the form of the statements. All that has to do with content. And I'm not going into detail what all that means. That's exegesis. So what do you do with all that? You've got to identify then those grammatical or content markers that are going to determine the structure. 2 points, 3 points, 4 points. And you're going to separate the major markers from the minor, like that major and the minor and. Some little changes are subpoints of a major point. A quote from Richard Ramish: just as bodies have big bones and little bones to connect and separate various parts from others, so biblical texts and all good writing feature big bones and little bones. You will use your interpretive judgments along with those of others, in other words, commentaries that you're studying and so forth, to understand the major and minor divisions of your text. Then you're going to outline the text now according to the relative importance of these markers, where the major changes are. Now, before I talk about outlining a little bit more, just a word of encouragement there. Be familiar with your language. If you're preaching in English, be familiar with English grammar. If you're preaching in another language, Afrikaans, whatever, be familiar with that language. Take a refresher course. When I went to seminary, the first thing we had to do was take an English exam. What do you know? You know what and you have to make 70 or above on the English little test. If you don't, your first semester or so of seminary, you've got to take a refresher English course in addition to all your regular courses. It is amazing. The average score on this usually is like 30 or 40. Why? Well, the older we are, the longer it's been since we had those English courses. Because it's asking questions about subjects and verbs and direct objects and indirect objects and pronouns and definite pronouns and so forth and prepositions and, wow, direct object, what's that? What's the difference between indirect object and direct object? State of being verb, action verb? Wow, I don't remember any of that. By God's grace, I had been principal of a Christian school for 6 years leading up to that little test, and I'd been teaching English at the high school level all those years. And so I was able to do okay, but most aren't. And that's just kind of common. And so I said this, I've taught this in Italy, and I've told the Italians, take an Italian refresher course. And so the Italian Theological Academy, where I teach sometimes, they do that. They offer an Italian refresher course. Be familiar with English or whatever language you're preaching in, because from that you're going to be helped to understand the text better. Even if you don't know Greek and Hebrew, you can make valid observations of the text based upon your own language. Now, I want to insert something right here that I don't have time to develop, but I hope I'll whet your appetite. One thing that helps people evaluate this passage is doing something called block diagramming. Block diagramming. It's not the kind of diagramming that I grew up on in school where you have all these lines and stuff and you diagram subjects and verbs and direct objects and all that, which I love, by the way. I'm kind of weird. But a block diagramming is something different, and I would encourage you to get Joel's material on this, his preaching material, that teaches how to do some block diagramming. But look back at that Ezra 10 verse. By block diagramming, I mean this. It's a way of taking the passage, and I'll do this on my computer. You know, you can cut and paste this whole passage on a piece of paper, and I start moving it. Major points, what I think is a major point or sentence in the passage, I have it over here to the left. And if there's a statement now that's supporting that, I indent it and move it in over here, you know, a little bit to the right. And so it gives me a visual picture as I evaluate the passage where the blocks are. Where are the major points? And so if I was going to block diagram that Ezra passage, literally it would look something like this. I'd have over here, for Ezra had set his heart. And that's not part of my outline. That's too big. It's controlling the entire sermon. I'm going to talk about it before I get into my outline. What he had done. What it meant to set his heart towards something. And then I'm going to have a plural noun. Three something. Just not things. And then I'm going to have right here indented to study. And I'm going to indent one more time. The law of the Lord. And then back to where study was. In that same place. One indention. To practice it. And then a little break, and then to teach, and over here, his statutes and his ordinances. In other words, it's a visual sort of representation where the passage major points are out here, where the supporting statements are here. Sometimes when I'm struggling with a passage, I will literally do that on a piece of paper and keep moving it and playing with it and go, no, the more I look at it, this is a supporting thought. This is just supporting this other point. This is a subpoint, not a major point. I need to move that in. And I get it all refined, and I can look at it and go, there's a point, there's a point, there's a point, and there's a point. So I've got these four blocks of material. Sometimes I just do it mentally. I can just kind of look at it and go, I can see it here, here's a block, here's a block, here's a block. And then with those blocks, what you're doing is asking then the same question you asked about the whole theme. You're asking the question, what does this block say? What does this portion say? What's the point of this block number one? What's the point of this block number two? And as I write that out, that becomes some of the information I use to craft my outline points. Because each one of the outline points is summarizing that little block of verses right there. That's where we get the wording for our outline points, which I'll talk about in a moment. So I'm just going to throw that in right now. I'm not doing a lot of time on it. I'm not even giving you an example on it, but I would encourage you to look at Joel's material. There's other books that talk about block diagramming. Even if you don't do it literally on a piece of paper, you'll find yourself, once you learn how to do it and practice it, you'll find yourself you're doing it mentally as you look at the passage. All right, so you've got a theme statement. This is the overall passage. It's how to have assurance in the face of adversity. We as Christians are expected to live this way no matter what we're facing. And we face a lot of difficulty. How can we do it? Well, in this psalm, we find three keys to having assurance in the face of adversity. Key number one, and so forth. Now, some do's and don'ts now about forming the outline. Don't force an outline upon the text. The text controls everything. The text controls the theme of your sermon. I mean, don't do what some do. They read a passage, pull out one little word that caught their attention, and launch out on some topical sermon on that one little word that had nothing to do with the passage. Don't allegorize passages. You know, the passage is about, you've heard these before, these are the classic examples, the passage is about the resurrection and going to the tomb and finding the stone rolled away and reading that great passage and then go, let's talk about that. What are the stones in your life that need to be rolled away? How about the stone of anger and the stone of anxiety, you know? I remember saying that one time, I think it was in Russia, to some guys, some men who had come for hours to learn how to preach and better, and they've been preaching and not trained or anything, and just doing the best they can, and I'm using that as an example, and they're all looking at one another like, uh-oh. And I got the impression they've all preached that sermon, you know, in their churches. Or, you know, David and Goliath, you know, reading that section, you know, and he throws the stones at Goliath, the giant. So what are the giants in your life? Well, we destroy the giant of anger with the stone of whatever. That has nothing to do with that text. You have to ask yourself, when you develop the theme statement, when the original readers read this paragraph, what did they think when they heard it? They heard a literal man named Goliath and David using literal rocks. I mean, it's a great story about the sovereignty of God and God protecting his people and the redemptive story and all that. Some great stuff there, but it has nothing to do with stones destroying giants. You know what? To take that approach in your preaching, you don't need the Bible at all. You can do it with newspapers, magazines, anything. You know, you don't need the Bible. Let the text control everything. The theme, let the text control the number of points. Don't force it on there. In that paragraph, if there's three blocks, there's 3 points. I heard a sermon one time, one of the students, he preached the paragraph, but then he added a fourth point from another book, another chapter over here in another book. He just wanted to complete the thought with point number 4. And going, don't do that. That point's not in this passage. If you want to reference that in your conclusion or something, just to add some concluding thoughts, that's okay, but it's not part of this text. Number 2, each point should serve a specific purpose. The point fulfills that plural noun proposition. If you have said, this is a passage about what it means to be a godly man, what does a godly man look like? This passage gives us 4 characteristics of a godly man. Then what you give them better be 4 characteristics. Not 2 characteristics, and then a reason for being godly, and then a result of being godly man. That's inconsistent. No, if it's 4 marks of a godly man, each one's a mark. So the plural noun or the outline fulfills that plural noun proposition. As you form those outlines and as you word them, there's 3 major types of outlines. So I've given to you in your notes. I want to talk about that for a moment. We're going to look at some of Smedley's and Joel's and mine and so forth this week. There's what we call markers of the text. That's one kind of outline. A marker of the text means the outline point doesn't have a subject or verb in it. It doesn't make a statement. It's not telling you to do anything. It's just like a marker along the way that guides your progress through the passage. Many sermons follow this. For example, look at page 47. Smedley preached this the other night, or sometime this week. Page 47. On Revelation 2, the church that left its first love. church at Ephesus. He doesn't have it written there, but I remember what he called them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. It was 6 elements was the plural noun he used, elements. I don't remember his theme statement and all that. But look at those outline points. Are they complete sentences? No. Does the word salutation tell you to do anything? No. It's just a marker. It's a marker of the text. He used it in that sermon in Revelation 20. This is not in your notes, but last night, I think it was last night, he preached Revelation 20. He used the plural noun factors, and there were markers of the text, if I remember right. Page 53 in our syllabus, he has 7 characteristics of the kind of man required to fight for the unity in the church. Characteristic number 1, under submission. Now, as they're worded right there, they're just markers. If he puts the word he in front of it, he is, number 1, he is under submission. Number 2, he is not quarrelsome. That changes it to the next kind of marker that we'll get to in just a moment. But markers of the text are just words. I've given you a couple examples that are just, I think that first set in your syllabus is just made up. It's not a real sermon. The command, the method, and the results. Maybe there's a text on evangelism or something. You know, the command, the method, the results. You've heard a lot of sermons that way. Just markers. That next selective obedience, all that, that was the outline that went with that sermon from 1 Samuel about symptoms of an unrepentant heart. 4 symptoms of an unrepentant heart: selective obedience, superficial confessions, selfish motivations, shallow externalism. They're not telling you to do anything. They're not complete sentences. They're just markers. If you'll go through Joel's sermons, page 71, 77, 79, 81, you'll find that he has used markers several times. But what I want you to notice is they can have more words than just 1 or 2 words. Look at page 71. Number 1, Jeremiah's divine calling. There's 3 words. It's still just a marker. Jeremiah's divine courage, number 2. Jeremiah's divine message, number 3. Markers of the text. Page 77. He has 4 words in each of the outline points. Still markers. The problem of crime. That was today. Number 2, the solution to crime. That was it. 2 of them. 2 things. I don't know what to call them. It may be there somewhere. But they're just markers of the text, even though there's 4 words involved. My favorite teacher, Pam Hardy, you start on page 85. She loves markers of the text. If you look at her material on page 85, intimacy with God. The basis for intimacy with God. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 words. Still just a marker. Doesn't tell you to do anything. Doesn't ask a question. The benefits of intimacy with God. The barriers to intimacy with God, and so forth. And I could look at some of mine. I've got the same thing. There's a on the last one there, the unique necessity of Christian love, the distinctive character of Christian love, the sobering test of Christian love. A lot of words there. That was the sermon, my sermon on John 13 about Jesus' last words to the disciples. 6 words, but just markers. You've got some adjectives. You've got a prepositional phrase. It's just a marker. That's 1 outline point. Next kind of outline point. An outline that makes a statement, or the opposite of a statement is a question. So I group them together. Here's a sermon outline there on Psalm 92 about worship. I think 3 facts about worship or something like that. Number 1, worship involves celebration. Worship involves adoration. Worship involves expectation. There's a subject and a verb. It makes a complete statement. You've got examples this week. Joel on page 75. And Smedley on page 45, but Joel's on page 75. 3 reasons that the church is not to incorporate worldly wisdom into the gospel to update or improvement. Reason number 1, it creates a powerless gospel. That is a complete statement. Number 2, it creates a consumer gospel. Number 3, it conflicts with God's plan for the gospel. Smedley had a similar one, I think, something like that on page 45. I did one earlier this week, yesterday, page 5. I think it had to do with the excellent minister. 3 characteristics of an excellent minister. And each one was a complete statement. He prioritizes the truth. Number 2, I don't remember my sermon now, but it was in there. Third kind of outline point, directives. A directive is an outline point that actually is a command or gives direction of what to do. The nice thing about these kind of outline points is that the application is built into the outline. That first example, understand God's process, embrace God's will, that was a sermon of mine from Philippians 4. Four keys to contentment, where Paul is talking about how to be content. How can we be content? The theme is not just Paul had learned to be content in any circumstance. The theme is broader than that. It's Christians can be content in any circumstance, no matter what life brings their way. But how? How can we be content? Well, there are four keys here. Number one, understand God's process. Number two, embrace God's will, and so forth. That's telling you what to do. On page 33 of your notebook, there is an example of this. I actually haven't preached it yet. Maybe I shouldn't even talk about it. It's tomorrow. Three exhortations. You've got the theme statement on page 33. It's a little bit higher than that. All of this is providing us the reasons. Here's the theme. We should take our commitment to Christ seriously, even though we're going to increasingly face persecution in this world. There's the theme of this passage. How do we do that? This passage gives us three exhortations that outline our job description, essentially outline our job description. There's the plural noun, three exhortations. Stay close. Number two, stay something else, and so forth. Those are commands. Psalm 3, I keep referencing Psalm 3. The outline is there in the notes. What are the? How can a Christian, a God's people, have assurance in the face of any adversity? Number one, trust in the wisdom of God's providence. Number two, rest in the knowledge of God's care. Number three, hope in the certainty of God's victory. They're telling you what to do. They start with a verb. Those are directives. Now, I don't necessarily have a preference. I guess if you twisted my arm, I guess I'd say my preference is I love directives. But the passage has to determine that. It doesn't fit all the time, see. Statements, I love statements, but it doesn't always fit. Markers of the text, nothing wrong with that. Sometimes that's the best. Here's what you're going to learn, though. The more you try to work with these three types of outlines, there are some rules and regulations here. One is that certain plural nouns go with certain types of outlines. Certain of these plural nouns in English better fit markers of the text. Certain plural nouns fit statements or questions. Certain plural nouns go well with directives. Sometimes when I hear the students preach, they've picked a plural noun and they've got markers of the text, but they're not really markers. The plural noun fits better with some other kind of outline, so I help them come up with another plural noun. So you want those to match and not to be a disconnect there. Let me go back to statements and questions just for a moment. I didn't give you an example of any questions, but I have found that when I'm struggling with an outline, really struggling, if nothing else, I have found that if I craft the outline point in the form of questions, it seems to all work all of a sudden. So I like questions. Every once in a while, I'll just do it on purpose. You know, this passage emphasizes the importance of prayer in the Christian's life. And it answers three very important questions for us about prayer. Here's question number one. Why is prayer required? Here's question number two. You know, why is prayer effective? Question number three, why is prayer so difficult? You know, I'm just making that up. I don't have a sermon for that. I wish I did. That's what some guys do. Some people do. You know, they make up a good outline. I'll find a text somewhere to fit this outline. That's too good. That'll preach. Yeah, I like questions. And if nothing else works, it always works. But nevertheless, here's some do's and don'ts here that continues in your outline now, your syllabus. Each point should be distinct. Distinct. In other words, sometimes you'll find that as you craft these outlines, I think we're on number four, maybe in page 25 there, you'll find that you came up with four blocks, but the more you work with it, these four points, you have this nagging suspicion that point number two and point number three are so similar, you really don't have four points, you just have three, and you need to merge those two together. And what you end up having is a couple of subpoints then under the point two. So be open to that. Don't be so determined that I have got the most perfect outline in the world. I have found the outline to end all outlines. They're going to write books about me after I die because of this outline right here. These 4 points. You might better be a little bit honest about it and realize point 3 and 4 are too close together. You only have 3. So be open to that. Look at it. You know, make that observation because each point should be distinct. Write in the present tense. I've already emphasized that. Don't put it, look back up to that outline, trust in the wisdom of God's providence. Don't say, David trusted in the wisdom of God's providence. Number 2, David rested in the knowledge of God's care. Number 3, David hoped in the certainty of God's victory. That's true, he did. But it's not about David. It's about you. So write it in present tense, timeless principle form. In general, you try to avoid proper names if at all possible. I suppose if you're doing a character study, you're going to have to, you know, word it a certain way. But make it timeless. And state the point clearly. State it clearly. Call attention to it. Make sure people know this is an outline point. If you just word it clearly, not only should we trust in the wisdom of God's providence, but here's a second key to having assurance in the face of adversity. What an important key this second key is. The second key is rest in the knowledge of God's care. I said it about 3 times there. Okay? This is the second one. Okay, I got it. It's not bad to do that at all. Number 8, put a star by this one. Well, mainly because my wife is here listening and she talks to me about this one. Be careful that outline points are not too complicated. You ever read the Puritans? You see how they title chapters and things like that, you know? Point number 1. The reason that all God's people should be praying all kinds of prayers, including intercession, petition, and thanksgiving in every circumstance, regardless of what life gives. Point number 1. Your people trying to take notes on that one are not going to like you. Okay. Unless you're using a PowerPoint or something. My wife gave me that good advice. Keep your outline points simple. Make what you say in the sermon profound. That's good advice, because sometimes I'll run an outline by her. I'll say, read this passage. I got this outline, you know, and it's got about 10 words in it, or it's got some hard words in it. And she'll say, well, that's kind of complicated. I don't know what you're trying to say with that. And I'll try to make my case. Oh, don't worry about it. I'm going to explain it. It'll be all clear when I get it explained, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And it's like, well, I'm just telling you, keep your outline simple. You can still be profound in what you say. Major points especially need to be clear. Subpoints, if the people lose the subpoints a little bit, that's not near as bad as if they really go away. I never did get 4 marks of a godly man. I think I got 1. What were the other 3? Did you get those? Well, no, I got 2. Wow, I didn't even hear that one. If your people are saying that, something's wrong with the clarity. Parallelism and symmetry are important. And there's different ways you can accomplish that. If you look back upon those outline examples, whether they're Joel's or Smedley's or mine or Pam's, whatever, you'll see a constant theme. Whatever type of outline we've chosen, the statements, the outline points are parallel in some way. They're symmetry. Look back up there. Trust in the wisdom of God's providence. It starts with a verb. Then there's a prepositional phrase. Then a second prepositional phrase. It follows that pattern in each one. Worship involves celebration. Worship involves adoration. Worship involves expectation. There's symmetry. And the reason that's important, if you can accomplish it, it helps your people know, oh, he's on a major outline point. It's fitting the pattern. I know exactly where we are. That's just if you want to be clear. And so you accomplish that with parts of speech. Alliteration is okay. Be careful about alliteration. First of all, there's more than one kind of alliteration. We tend to think of first letters of words. If you look at that one I just read, worship involves celebration, worship involves adoration, there is some alliteration there. It's the I-O-N at the end of each of the last words. That's alliteration as well. I love I-O-N words, I-N-G words, and so forth to get parallelism that way. But sometimes you'll have it at the beginning of an outline. I gave you one earlier. Selective obedience, superficial confession, selfish motivation. There's that first word that starts with S. Alliteration's okay. I did it this morning in the lecture on the flesh. At the end, I gave you 3 R's. But I intentionally do not alliterate all my outlines. And if I've had a couple of outlines that were alliterated with the first letter, the next two or three sermons, I intentionally do not. I don't want the people to think I do this every time. Something else you have to be careful about alliteration. Don't overdo it. And I've been guilty of that. You've got three words in the outline. All the first words start with S, all the second words start with C, and all the third words start with, you know, L or something. What happens is, once you get the first two going, well, now you're in a trap. You got to keep it going. And you get to those other outline points, you can't think of any words. So you go to the thesaurus, and you pull out words that haven't been spoken in 200 years. You know? But it's a C word. I need a C. You know? And that gets cutesy. It gets kind of trickery. That's really not good. Don't do that. In fact, if I find that my first one kind of naturally started with an S, second one started with an S, and the third one's like, well, I guess I need an S here, but I can't come up with one, I go back and change one of the others to get rid of the S. Just be careful about alliteration. You don't have to have it all the time. But some form of symmetry and parallelism helps your people listen. Any subordinate points should relate to the main point. In other words, if you have two subpoints, there's a reason they're there. Now they're supporting the main point. And what's interesting about subpoints is, generally, you will have another plural noun to describe what they are. For example, look on page 5 of your syllabus. And I'll use one of mine, and maybe somebody else's, or maybe they're just mine here, but I notice them in Joel's as well. On page 5, you've got the three characteristics of an excellent minister. Number one, characteristic number one, he prioritizes the truth. And then I had three subpoints, and I called them proofs. These three subpoints relate to the main point. If they don't relate to the main point, something's wrong. They're fleshing out now the main point, and you need to call them something. If I feel like the numbers are getting too much here, you know, every outline point has, you know, I've got three characteristics, but now two proofs, and the next one is the second characteristics, and there's four evidences, and the third characteristic, and I got too many of those numbers, sometimes I'll just leave the numbers out. And I'll just say, here's some proofs of this prioritizing truth. I just won't say how many there are. Sometimes that helps people. I had a class one time working on my doctorate, and there was a week on preaching, and that particular instructor said you should never tell your congregation how many points you're going to have in your outline. I disagree with that. I understand his reasoning. He said if you've got three characteristics of a godly man, four characteristics of a godly man, don't tell them there's four. Just say we're going to look at some characteristics of a godly man here. Here's the first one. And his reasoning was, when you finish that fourth one, people start closing their books and stuff like that. They're not listening anymore. And I don't find that to really be true. Every once in a while, I'll not tell them how many. But that's just for variety. But by and large, I tell them how many because I want to give them hope that they'll get to go home. They can go. We're almost there. Okay, hold on, kids. We're almost there. There's just one more because he said there'd only be four. He didn't tell us there'd be a 45-minute conclusion. But nevertheless, and he preached another sermon. Not that that ever happens. Page 35. Look at page 35. The one tomorrow, it's going to have some subpoints under number 2. Number 2, stay consistent, but then you look down, three aspects of our holding fast. The object of our holding fast, I can't find where they are now, but the manner of our holding fast, and then the basis of our holding fast. What's interesting is I use one type of outline for the major points, and then markers of the text for these subpoints. That's okay. Don't change the kind of major point that you have, though. And I'll come back to that in a moment. So, subordinate points, they need to support the main point. Don't have too many subpoints. I have heard some sermons where you have and I follow the old English style, I guess, of Roman numerals, number one, and then the next one is a capital letter A. And if you have something like that, it's a number one. If you have something like that, it's a little A. If you have something like that, it's a little minor case Roman numeral I. I've heard some sermons where the guy was trying to get people to follow something like that. And he's like 8 subpoints deep over here into this. People can't follow that. If you've got a handwritten outline, that's one thing. If you've got a syllabus in a class, that's another thing. But verbal preaching, keep it simple. Don't have too many subpoints or subpoints that are cumbersome. By and large, once you get past just one level of subpoints, the other stuff is probably just for you to keep track of stuff while you're preaching, like bullet points. Some common errors I point out. Just common errors that summarize some of what I've said. Lack of connection to the proposition. In other words, the outline you said would be markers, but now one of them's not a marker. Lack of symmetry. Redundancy, because you need to combine some points. Too complicated. Wrong divisions. No textual basis for the outline point. Those are common problems, so avoid those. All right, so you've got the theme statement. You've got a plural noun proposition that'll give guidance to your outline. You've got 2 points, 3 points, 4 points. I am amazed at how many sermons really just have 2 points for me. But whatever, I very seldom have. I mean, there's been a couple of passages where there were 6 or 7 and couldn't help it. That's just the way it was. But not too many have more than that. Next in your notes, maintain a logical flow of thought. I mentioned to you that while you're going through this, what time are we supposed to end, by the way? 4? All right, I will. While you're going through this, remember that I said there's a dotted line running down through that thing. You're taking them on a path. That means there's a logical flow of thought in everything you're saying in this pass. It's all moving from top to bottom. It's a journey. If you keep the flow of thought logical, it ensures that your structure is not obscured. It enables the audience to identify and follow the movement from one major point to the next. So here's some things to keep in mind. Make sure you understand the flow of thought yourself. And you've heard this before. Mist in the pulpit will result in fog in the pew. If you're trying to work it out while you're preaching, trying to figure out what this thing's about, and you're sweating and it's rolling down the back of your legs, you know, trying to make it work. Because people are just staring at you like, I don't know where we are. What planet are we on? If that's what's happening, you really didn't nail it down yourself. But if you've got this journey in your mind, you can take them on that journey too. And I can't tell you how important it is to have time then to meditate on what you're studying. Put a big circle around that word meditate if it's in your notes. Because I'm telling you, you've got to absorb it. You've got to have time to think about what you've been studying. Maybe even in certain sections in there. Once you've been studying and making observations, once you've done a block diagram mentally, or once you've started coming up with some outline points, once you've got a bunch of data from things you've read, once you're working on an introduction, anywhere in there, to have some breaks where you're meditating on it. People ask me, when do you work on your sermon? I'm going, all the time. I'm mowing the yard and I'm thinking about it. There's not 4 points, there's only 3. Things like that. That helps you own the material, you're familiar with it. Create clear transitional statements. It's so helpful as you move from one part of the sermon to the next to key your people in with a transitional statement that now introduces the second point and the third point and so forth. Eliminate hindrances to a clear flow of thought. It's like a garden hose, you know, with water flowing in it, a pipe. And it can get clogged up inside there. And you got to get rid of the mud that's in there and stuff like that that's keeping the flow. Here are some mud clogs. No proposition or purpose statement. You didn't really tell them where you're going. You just sort of given them a sanctified stream of consciousness, you know, through the passage somehow. Complicated outline points. And they're all confused. They don't understand where you are. Unwieldy alliteration or forced alliteration. Changing the key propositional word, that's real common in my students. 4 marks of a godly man. Here's the first mark of a godly man. 2, here's the second mark of a godly man. We come to another characteristic or some other word of a godly man. And they're going, okay, is this the same as a mark or is this a subpoint? See, don't change the key word. Lack of parallelism. They can't quite tell if you're still on a major point or not. Lack of clear transition statements, and John Brodus has done a lot of good work on transitions. He has a good quote there you ought to read of how important they are. But just a few thoughts about transition statements. They are so important, that you need to think about these ahead of time. If you're one of those that doesn't write out all your sermon in a somewhat full manuscript or whatever, and you're just going to use a few bullet points, I still advise those kind of people with perfect memories maybe if they don't write anything else out, they write those transition statements out of moving from one point to the next because it's so helpful. And when I'm doing my final edit of my sermon on for Sunday morning, for example, I'm during Sunday school, just combing through it one more time, fine-tuning it as best I can, one of the things I'll look at is, are my transitions clear? Not reviewing outline points. Sometimes that hurts the flow of thought. It's helpful to review. We've seen one mark of a godly man, that he needs to be a man of prayer. Here's the second mark of a godly man. He needs to be a man of so forth. On the other hand, you can have too much review. That can happen if you've got an outline that has like 7 or 8 outline points. You can't review every single one every time. Do you have that song, The 12 Days of Christmas? It's like that, you know. And a partridge in a pear tree. What you do is you pick out just 2 or 3 places in there to review your outline points. Or maybe in the conclusion, review it. Lack of familiarity with the content of the message yourself. And that's why it's clogged down. Too many tangents. I hear this sometimes. You get thoughts in the pulpit. And so it's like by the way, that reminds me of something else over here in the Old Covenant of Israel. And really, by the way, you know, Israel was not the only nation that did that. And by the time they get done, they've got like 6 or 7 by the ways over here. And then it's a sudden way jump back over here to get back on the path. You can have a couple of by the ways, but be careful. Too many tangents. Dwelling too long on a tangent. Illustrations that don't apply. You're going to illustrate this point. I'll briefly talk about illustrations here in a moment. You're going to give this illustration that helps them understand it. It's something about your dog. And so you give the dog illustration. And either you don't do it very well or something. You leave out something. And you go on after that illustration to go to the next outline point. And they're all sitting there trying to figure out the dog illustration. What was the point of the illustration? Be careful about that. And using abstract language. Obscure words. You can use a word every once in a while you need to teach your people, but don't make it a habit. So there's the main sort of body of the sermon. You got the theme statement, the plural noun proposition, and your outline points that are all symmetrical and so forth. Now, before it, after it, within it, there's a place for illustrations. Just going to talk briefly about this. You can use illustrations that clearly relate to the main points. You get an illustration from life, your own experience, illustrations from history, illustrations from the news. I don't have an illustration on every point. I'm not even the best person to look at for illustrations. I find it hard to come up with good illustrations. So if I can think of one, I use it. I don't force it. In fact, my belief is no illustration is better than a bad illustration because it throws people off. But if you can find them, if you can use them, they are helpful. It helps people kind of bridge the gap there between the theology and life. So illustration can be helpful. Next, use an appropriate introduction that sets the path. So up at the top, you're going to take them on a path. You know what the theme statement is. It's about this. It's about assurance in the face of adversity. We can have assurance in the face of any trial that comes along. And here are the keys. So this is what it's all about. What's your introduction they're going to have to do about? Something about adversity. Something about trials in life. There's so many kind of difficult situations that we have in life. We find ourselves in financial difficulties. We find ourselves in family difficulties sometimes, the tension that can be in the family. So you sort of wax eloquent on the subject of difficulties and trials, and that sets the stage, and then you make a bridge from that to your theme. What do we do about all this? What do we do about life when it's so hard? Well, we turn to the Word of God, and we can find help in this. In fact, Psalm 3 is a passage that we see from the example of David that we as God's people, we can have confidence no matter what happens in our lives. In fact, this passage gives us 3 keys to having that confidence. It's all a path. It's all a flow of thought that all connects. So your introduction needs to set that path, which means it's related to the overall point of the teaching. I violate this sometimes because I just can't think of a good introduction. But there is a rule here you try not to violate. The introduction needs to be about the overall theme of the sermon and not just one of the points. It's real easy to have an introduction that really relates to point number two. That really should not be an introduction to the sermon. That really should be an illustration of point number two. Move it down there. Come up with another introduction. Don't be trite. Don't do silly things. I love questions in the midst of introductions. Once you set the stage, ask a question. What about you? Are you in any trials right now? Do you have a difficult situation facing you right now? How does God want you to respond to it? Ask questions. Even if they've been daydreaming, they suddenly get back because you're asking them something. It ends then, the introduction ends with the proposition, your theme statement, and then your plural noun proposition. Make smooth transitions. The right length of an introduction. How long should an introduction be? There's the answer. As brief as possible and as long as necessary. I do have to help my students sometimes. Like I said, it's a 30-minute sermon. Minimum of 28, maximum of 31, just to teach them how to abide by the clock. I know they'll violate it in their real life. But in a 30-minute sermon, I've had some students that their introduction is like 8 minutes long. I go, wow, that's you're wasting a lot of good preaching time right there with that introduction. Just shorten it. You could edit that whole story of your life. You gave me every detail of that experience. No, just get the main points there. Use an appropriate conclusion. So there's the other end of the path. The conclusion is going to summarize everything and enforce the main point of the theme of the sermon. And it's very important. Both of these are important. It brings it to an appropriate ending rather than a stop. I do have a friend. He's a good preacher. And he does it better sometimes than others, but he's really known for this. He gets up in the pulpit. All right, 1 Corinthians 5, verse 1. Let me read. And he just starts. And then when he finishes his last statement, you know, so we need to be a godly man. Okay, let's pray. And it's over. You know, well, you can do that. And he's such a good preacher, it works anyway. But you know, we can give the Lord maybe something a little more creative, a little better. Think of how to end this sermon and have a smooth transition to it. You're making it now personal in tone. How does it affect their will, their affections? Drive the point home. With an appeal, you're going to compel them to respond now to this sermon somehow. What are the implications and applications for their life? You're going to encourage their obedience. You're going to caution them and rebuke disobedience. It's answering the so what of the whole sermon in a sense. Don't add a lot of new material. And it's like a plane that's about to land. It's coming in. And all of a sudden you hear, boy, the plane takes off again. We're going somewhere else. And, you know, and preach another whole nother sermon and all that. No, bring it to an appropriate end. Don't add a whole lot of new material. You can have some bullet points sometimes that are little implications of how to flesh it out in your life. Could be an illustration, a quotation, whatever can help. Somewhere in the sermon, make an appeal to unbelievers. I don't care where you preach. By and large, you want to appeal to unbelievers. You don't know where people are. If nothing else, in the conclusion, do it there. Like the introduction, the length, as long, as short as possible, as long as necessary. Lastly, in the sermon or in the conclusion, you do want to finish out the definition of expository preaching, explaining what the text means, what it means, what it says, what it means by what it says, and how it applies to life. You might do that along the way. That's a preference issue, making application along the way, for example. Or it might be in the conclusion, where you find it the most powerful to kind of bring it all home. This is what we do with this, folks. I personally prefer implications versus applications. There's a slight difference. Implications are broader and they apply to everybody. You can make more specific applications, but I've heard some that are too specific. They make them so specific that some of the congregation, many of them, it doesn't apply to them. Maybe it's something about showing love to an unbeliever, and so they make it so specific. In our town, for example, we have these things on Friday nights downtown with food and music and stuff, and you can say, the next time you go downtown on a Friday night, and you're there at the corner of 3rd and 4th Street in Maine, and a homeless person comes by there, and they're holding all these bags, and you're in that moment, and you and your wife, you know, your spouse, and you got your children there, here's what you can do. And so every statement they make, he cuts out another portion of the congregation. Many of them going, I never go down there on Friday night. I don't like that sort of thing. I don't know any homeless people. I'm not married. I'm married, but I don't have any children. You got to be careful of making applications so specific that it misses a large portion of the congregation. And that's why I like implications along the way or saved until the conclusion. The point of this seminar is clarity. It is crucial. This is where good content can fail. It's just not communicated well. And it ends up being confusing and unclear. There is no virtue, as your notes say, in sloppiness and being vague. So one more time, just look at that diagram. An introduction that sets the tone. A theme statement that summarizes the point of the sermon and the passage. And then a plural noun statement that's going to give direction to the outline now of how many ever points you have. And then a conclusion that brings it all home. If you just keep that picture in mind right there, you've got a template to go by that can be a go-to template, a default setting template. I will vary from this from time to time, but not too often, because it just ends up being a good way for people to follow what you're saying. And you've actually heard Smedley follow this. You've heard Joel follow this. I follow it. And we don't set ourselves up as greatest examples of preachers, but we do strive to be clear. That's the one thing I ask my wife sometimes. Was it clear? Where was it possibly confusing? Because if I fail there, I haven't been excellent to deliver it the best way to the people. Wish we had more time to talk about it. Let's pray. Father, you know the opportunity that each person has here to preach and to teach, whether teaching a Sunday school class or preaching a sermon, whatever it might be. I pray that you would burn within their heart a desire to be excellent in this way, good communicators, people who preach with clarity, accurate for sure, passionate for sure, in an appropriate manner, Christ-focused for sure. But Lord, I pray that it would not all break down because we just don't put the effort into working hard at being clear. I am grateful, Lord, that in spite of the many times that I do fail, that your word is so powerful that it has inherent power. And you use even my feeble attempts in a way that's beyond what I could think to impact people's hearts. That even when I think it's not so great a sermon, you take it and use it for your purposes. We do rest in that most of all. We just want to be excellent in your eyes to give you our best. Help us to do that. In Christ's name, amen.